at. So if I had a Bayesian hat, I'd put it on. Instead, I have this. So, you all know what's coming. Well, which way? You can all leave if you want. Good. All right. Okay. There's a story to tell, sort of background to this talk. I was actually the invited discussion, what is called proposer, in the Royal Statistical Society session where Susan Murphy presented her paper in 2003. And I made some comments. Nobody ever seemed to read those, or if they did, then they simply didn't care. I was sort of wondering, what's wrong? I proposed some alternative approach, and I thought that's what I proposed then should be put on test. And this is the test, because I have people who understand the problem very well, and I'm trying to propose some use of Bayesian methods that are somewhat different than what Susan was proposing or what Jamie has been proposing, and this is the test. I actually wrote to, when this paper, I saw this paper by Erica et al, I wrote to David Stevens and asked him actually a little bit if he knew the idea why Bayesian approaches had not been tried in the context, and he said maybe they're just difficult to model. And that may be the case. Anyway, let's move on ahead. I think this is obvious what is coming. It's all really done in the context of this Max study. Is that chalk? Yeah, there's a chalk. So there is, to make life simple, there's an X1, which is a CD4 count at the baseline. Then there is AZT treatment, yes or no. A1. During the first 6 months, and then CD4 count is again measured at 6 months, and then after you actually during the next 6 months, there is a possibility to start AZT treatment if it's not started already. Of course, if it was started, then somehow this becomes somehow redundant, and in the end you have again, a measured CD4 count at 12 months. So it looks like this. You have three arms, essentially. Here, you start the AZT treatment already, and then you go on to 12 months. Or if you didn't, then you have this other option of starting the AZT treatment somewhere between 6 and 12 months. So that's the thing. It's a very simple one. Essentially the times are fixed, 0 and 6 months and 12 months, and it's a simple thing in the sense that what actually is measured, the X, they are CD4 counts, and the final response is not survival, but that's also CD4 count. So that, I think, makes the modeling issue somewhat simpler. But in principle, we could think of survival here as the final response too. The model, of course, would have to be a bit different. So then there's no unmeasured confounders thing that I'm postulating here. And what it means is really that you don't assume that you have things that actually are so latent variables that are here. I mean, suppose you just ignore this for a while and think about this arm where you go directly to the final thing. Then if there are latent variables that would somehow explain the assignment of this, then they should not be predictive for this, the final response also. Or if you have latent variables that are predictive for this, then they should not be predictive for this. Because if you did that, have that a common thing, then you'd have confounding. And I'm assuming that the situation is in control. Okay, I guess. Yeah, same kind of thing is happening here again. Now, once you come to this point, then of course you have data. You have seen X1, you've seen the earlier assignment, which if you actually get here, it had to be that you did not initiate the AZT treatment yet. So you have the possibility of yes or no starting that again. but you have actually observed three things in such a case. But the same obvious reasoning holds in that case too. Okay. Now, I think I will just skip these because these are familiar things. Now, I'm actually doing this thing, the building up the statistical model in different modules. So there's the first module is the one that essentially, okay, we had, I'm just drawing it here again. So we had the X1, and then we had A1, and A1 could be zero. And then you actually say, if you initiate the treatment, if A1 was one, then you go directly to Y. So this is the simple thing. You go this simple path. These are not included. So that's one module of a model. And what we're doing is essentially we're trying to model these, the random variable Y, based on these two things. And because of what I said about confounding, we can actually condition on these two things. So initially, I'm not modeling the CD4 count at baseline. I'm just conditioning on that. And because this was non-informative, unmeasured confounders, I can also condition on this. I do likelihood-based inference. And so when you sort of move from here to there, this is not, to a Bayesian, this is not contributing information to that would be a predictive value to your likelihood. So you can just condition on these two things and then predict why. And that's what the first module of this model is going to be. And the key postulate here is that I assume that actually, I mean, this is simple. This A1, we know that has to be one. So there's something that is a continuous variable. Yes, Tom?
So when you said you're predicting Y,
yes.
If A1 is equal to zero, then what do you say?
Okay, but now I'm assuming that I've already gone beyond the A1 value, and this is, I have actually, let me just say, so I have initiated the AZT treatment, and then I predict why.
You have or you haven't?
I have initiated. I'm in this particular arm, the simple arm, and it's a bit more complicated, and I'll talk about that later, what you do if you have not initiated. So here you have the A1 is 1, you have initiated, and you might actually, of course, you could do this in two stages. You could go to 6 months, and then you could go from 6 months. But I just make a simple step all the way to 12 months. And then I assume that there is essentially an increasing function, F1, that is somehow describing how you'd expect a person to respond at or what you expect the CD4 count to be at 12 months, given that you had X1I, so that refers to the individual at the baseline. Now, obviously, people are different. They respond differently. So this is like the systematic part. But I think it's quite natural also in view of the talk that we just heard that if you're CD4 count level is high now, it's more likely to be high also later. So that's the thing which I'm assuming, and we can of course also empirically test that, and I'll show you something after a while. Actually, it could be supported. Well, here you can see these scatter plots, X1, X2, and Y. And this actually, there are similar pictures in this Richardson, Moody, Stevens paper, and they look different, and I don't really know why, but they are much more random. We have we got actually data from on a disk. We ordered that by mail, and I think we had something like 1,300 people, and they had more. Yes. I'm trying to determine the optimal regime, treatment regime. Should you start treatment here, or if you delay that decision until 6 months, should you start it then or not at all? That's the issue. Okay, so these are fairly, I think, supportive of the idea that if you have X1 is high now, then it also predicts a high count at 6 months and similarly at 12 months. And the same thing is when you read X2, then it predicts these are really symmetric and you don't need to consider those. So if you have X2 here, then it predicts Y, which is the CD4 count, at 12 months. Okay, now this is the modeling assumption, and I'm using this idea that you essentially individual variability is like built on this increasing function in two steps. One is that you, for each individual, you draw a random variable from a gamma distribution which has mean at this f function. So you put in the x, and then you know that the mean of the gamma distribution is shape divided by scale. So if you do the alphas cancel, and the alpha then controls the variance, how much variance you have around this mean. And also, just to add even more variability, we then say that the actual count is a Poisson random variable. So you sort of draw a variable with this draw a variable from a gamma distribution with the mean that is given by the systematic part, and then you add more variability still by adding a Poisson. What is nice is that since the Poisson has expected value, which is the same as the parameter, and here the mean is this f, then if you take the expected value, then the expected value is again just precisely this f function. Now, the likelihood is quite simple. Since I'm using Bayesian inference, I'm actually putting also a prior on this alpha that can be estimated from the data. And then this f, of course, it's like a parameter, but it's a function. So it needs to be estimated also. But once you have these in, then and you condition on those, then you actually get via the z variables, you get to the final measurement. And the z variables are just intermediate here, so you can actually integrate them away in the end. You don't really need them. But the likelihood gets a very simple product form. Now, rest of the model are really very similar. So here you are, A1 was zero, so you did not assign AZT yet. And so you have the other variable, X2 being measured. And then now you're asking A2, is that zero or one? And so if it is one, say, then you come down here. And if it is zero, you go there. So you measure the y variable like that. And so there are similar building blocks in the model, in fact, three building blocks. One is analogous to this model which I just described, but it is for this path. So you go from these two variables, you go to the CD4 count at 6 months, not at 12 months. But otherwise, the rationale is just the same. And then once you come up here to 6 months, then you have two different possibilities depending on whether A2 was 0 or 1, and then you have one model, so there's a Y there and there's a Y here, and another model you have here. Now, those models are really just copies of this, with the exception that that here, when we come to this point, we actually have more information. We have not just x1 and the okay known value of A, which has to be 0, but we also this thing. And so we have two readings of the CD4 count. And let's see, then, so two readings of the CD4 count. And so if I'm trying to do something similar, then I need a function which is of two variables. But we can do that. I can't do the details here. But anyway, I'm assuming that I have a function which is monotone in both variables, both x1 and x2. So it's essentially estimating a surface which is increasing in both variables. And then I just plug it in, and so the rest is sort of can be written off just like this. So that's the definition of the model. It's four moduli here, here, there, and there. And obviously, in order to, this is kind of easy because there's nothing in between, but if you're thinking about this as a data generating mechanism, you have to sort of combine this module with this or with that and have these in-between values, x2, generated from this second module. And then, so it's a model. It has several functions that need to be put in. There are four modules. Each of them has its own f. Then we have the corresponding alpha parameters that control the variance. And then we're trying to estimate this whole thing from the data. So this is, in a way, it's basically an inference. It's also close to machine learning in the sense that the data is like a training data that we're using in order to have knowledge about the parameters. And then the other part is to actually issue predictions that we get by using the model, and then possibly compare them with what there were in the data in reality. So the idea is a very concrete one. You try to think about, I mean, these are the different alternatives. Either you start now or you delay, and you either start there or you still don't. So there are three different things that you'd like to compare to each other. And these are actually, you can think of these as do conditioning. You have some hypothetical person, a generic individual who comes in, and then you say, okay, I want to try on you different predictions by forcing you to follow one of these protocols. And then you can choose any one of these three protocols, and then print out the predictive distribution of the final variable y. I guess this is just sort of redoing things that I did when specifying the model. So it's fairly easy, really, because of the Poisson and the gamma things. We get the expected values very simply. We don't have to. If we just concentrate on the expected value of the y, then we don't have to generate the final output and then average from the simulation. But we can just plug in the parameter values and get that. This is all done very easily, since we are using MCMC, then by data augmentation. It's like adding this one generic chap to the data. And then as you are estimating, turning the big wheel and sampling parameters, you can always sort of generate additional histories for this one guy, or three more guys, say. One following this coming here, another one going there, and a third one going there. And so you can print out the predictive distributions like that. Okay, now the next thing is how do we essentially optimize? And the idea is a classical one, Richard Bellman's dynamic programming. So we move backwards. We see if we were actually here, then what And then we know that actually we had not assigned, we had not started AZT treatment yet. So the question is, do we start it now? And we have information on the on these two variables, X1 and X2, and we'd like to see what combination possibly favors our starting it now or not starting it now. And so that's a simple thing in principle. We just compute those expected values, and you don't have to read this because it's obvious. You just choose the one out of these two. So here's A2 equals 1, and here's A2 equals 0. The rest are the same. So you have the same variables, same CD4 counts in the past. You did not start AZT treatment yet, and you have these two options. Which one of the two is giving you a higher expected value for Y? And you choose the one which is supposed to give you a higher response. And so then once you've so decided what is this thing here, then you move back to the baseline. And at the baseline, you don't really have the second X2 reading yet. So you need to also predict that. But then you say, okay, I predict that, but then my optimal regime is that whatever I actually get it, I will do it optimally from then on. And so this is the idea of the dynamic programming. Okay. So that's putting things together. That's the optimal regime. Now, we can, of course, now compare different treatments. We have these three different possibilities, and we have data, so we can estimate these things and see what comes out. And then here's results from that analysis. I already said that we can actually do this by data augmentation, and it's a bit more difficult actually to say what is the predictive distribution if you follow the optimal thing, because first you need to know what is optimal. So you need two MCMC runs, if you like, or a very long one where you first determine the optimum policy, and then you sort of say, okay, now I switch to that, and then start printing also the predictive. But these, where the protocols are fixed, then they can be started as soon as you sort of pass your burn-in. Now, what actually turns out to be the case is that there's almost no difference here, at least for the data, and it's similar to the paper by Erica and her co-authors. So this is now simply the predictive mean. We get whole predictive distributions, and I can show you after a while what those look like. But if you look at the predictive distributions, now few people actually have CD4 counts that are bigger than 1,000, and very few beyond 1,500. Here it seems that you're actually, there's no difference. There seems to be a slight difference between the three protocols, and here seems to be again something, but there's so little data out here that I think that and it would concern so few people in reality that we can just about forget it and cut it off somewhere here. So there seems to be not very great news, at least. Well, this is old data from the, I think, late 80s or something, so this is just really taken for an illustration, not to give big news to medical community. This is now a comparison of different treatment regimes. If you put in the opt at the second stage, so it's still as a function from X1, which is the reading which you have at the baseline, and then you say, okay, I don't know what X2 is going to be, I have to sample it from the model, and then you plug in whatever you got, And essentially, in order to do this, you do an integration over the x2 variables. And then also you plug in the opt in this green color thing. So here's where you start it right away. It's the short arm here. And here is where you take this other arm and then use the opt at this point. So there's some difference, maybe no difference really in here, but perhaps one could say that on this there's a marginal improvement if you follow the delayed thing. Don't start yet, but plug in the opt later. All right, and this I think I would just ignore. Now here you can see in two dimensions, here's x1, and what I've actually, I didn't say that, but I should have, is that I'm not assuming that it's increasing in x1 and x2, but it's increasing x1 and x2 minus x1, because x2 minus x1 is the difference. So if you come down, you were high up first, but then you're actually sort of fallen, and the CD4 count is much lower than it was at the baseline, then I think it's bad news. And so what we actually did was we assumed that this f function is monotone in x1 and then in this difference. And you see that actually sort of usually things, okay, there's a zero. So if in general, things become worse in this data. I guess AZT treatments were not that great, and the prognosis were 20 years ago were really quite a little worse. You see some regions here, and I think this just that you don't have like a country's clear regions where one or the other would be better is an outcome of the fact that. The data really have very little information. There's randomness that just about compensates for the signal that there might be. Now, these are actually completely predictive distributions, and they are taken on the deciles. So you've taken like the 10th smallest x1, and then you predicted the y for the him under three different protocols. And so you have these three different colors. And it's, there's some systematic change here, of course. When the baseline measurement of x1 becomes higher, then also your predictive distribution moves to the right for obvious reasons and becomes less peaked. This can be compared with the empirical things that we had. This is just... this was finished, I should have said, and it was on the first slide. It was a PhD student of mine, Olli Saarala, who's done these computations. This last one, actually, he sent to me yesterday. So I this is all new, and we are going to do more model checking. I sort of just took it, this gamma distribution and Poisson on top and all that, I just took out of my head and would like to do more diagnostics on this later. But it seems to be doing all right based on this. Some comments. I think it is true that it's really axiomatic, I think, in causality that cause should precede the effect. But that's not often respected. You could say that it's implicit in the graph, or you could make the graph follow that. But people are often, it seems to me, really forgetting this thing. And if you're actually thinking about the sequence of this, it's like in the graph that we're just following the time sequence and write the likelihood in a sequential manner. And then if something that you get the next contribution in your expression does not depend on something in the past, then you strike those conditionings off as being irrelevant. So here I don't know that using a graph really would help very much because, well, it's a simple thing. This is really used for an illustration. Now, what have I say? Well, you see, this has almost, okay, there's some parameters in the gamma distribution, a Poisson parameter, if you like, but in the actual analysis, there are no coefficients, or there are no tests. There's nothing like that machinery. You just print out the predictions, and that's the thing that we were trying to get from the analysis. So I think, in some sense, there's a different focus, or if you think of products of the statistical analysis are in a different category than what they are commonly. Now, Jamie probably doesn't like this. I think the time ordering should be respected. No accelerated failure times. If you use individual accelerated failure times, then some people sort of take over some others, and time scales are mixed. That's not happening here, and it's not really needed in in any of these points. All right, let's just go quickly to the end. That's on computation, and I think that really the message can be conveyed. I'm not sure how well I did that, but in very simple terms, it's a very concrete thing to say. I have this predictive distribution. If you follow this, you have these measurements, then that's what you predict. And the uncertainty is actually described in the same analysis. Now, this is, of course, the printing these predictive distributions is very close to the G computation algorithm of Jamie. I don't know that they're really much different, but the statistical inference, the principles, and that analysis, which somehow gets us to doing that predictive computation, that is, of course, different. It's now the likelihood-based Bayesian thing that I've used here. And then another thing is that we're not putting plug-in estimates, but we are integrating with respect to the posterior distributions so that the uncertainty in the parameter value somehow is accounted for. In these predictions. Now, this doesn't mean that life is simple, and we've done all that, because obviously if you want to convince yourself that the no unmeasured confounders postulate is a reasonable one, then maybe you would really have to collect much more information than a CD4 count, as you've had here. And using printing out these predictive distributions does mean that you need to predict also the covariates. So you need models for the covariates. I had a simple one for predicting X2, but if you have a multivariate thing and you think of a doctor's doing seeing the patient once a week and then looking at 10 or 50 different things that came from the lab, then obviously this is not what I would be able to handle. And it'd be just nice to see how far we can possibly go, perhaps go by using the same machinery. The Erica et al. Paper was demystifying something, and I don't know. That was somewhat mysterious to me. I always skip a couple of pages there when they talk about blips and regrets and linearity and discontinuity. And now that's something that you have to decide. Thank you. Yes.
So I think just going back to demystifying, to some degree, so part of the context of that paper was that the method that's been proposed by Susan is a method that's been proposed by Jay. Mm-hmm. Part of the goal was to try to explain how those two methods relate.
Right, yeah.
I would say, for that reason, because we were trying to explain the methods in the simplest possible context, we concentrated on what is really a toy example.
Uh-huh,
yeah. And I think basically the methods, both as set up by Jamie and as set up by Susan, intended to be applied with many more covariates and many more different time points. And so, to be quite honest, I think in order to view this as being a viable contender,
Mm-hmm.
You would need to think about doing it for many more time points.
Yeah.
The computational challenges that you've identified would get larger in that context.
I'm sure it would, yeah. It'd just be nice to actually do that and see how far we get. Because I don't know. Well, I mean, this is somehow based on some first principles, and there are computational challenges and modeling challenges, I'm certainly. it was meant to be a toy example because here I can illustrate what I'm doing. I think, what are the ingredients?
One issue is that Susan and Jamie's procedures are set up so that in the situation where there is no treatment effect, your modeling assumptions on things, other things, are not going to will mean that you don't get spurious inference. And I think I wonder a little bit about whether that's still the case.
Yeah. Well, it seems to be giving very similar results and sort of good predictions that are in line with what they were in the data. So I think in that sense, the model is calibrated in the right way. And it does have ingredients which are causal, like the no unmeasured confounders in the terminology of Judea, or statistical, perhaps like the monotonicity, which I could verify from the data, whether it's a reasonable one. And certainly there would be contexts where I would sort of could not assume that I have a monotonicity property, for example. I could have a U-shaped. Then I would think, okay, maybe there's some minimum which I would have to estimate, and then I would have monotonicity on both sides. So I've not really tested those ideas yet. Yes?
So this is following up with Tom says, the reason I moved away from the G-computation algorithm very early is explained in a paper by Larry Wasserman and I called On the Null Paradox. Mm-hmm. The problem is that suppose neither A1 nor A2 had any causal effect, why at all? Nonetheless, it can be that the conditional distribution of y, given a2, x2, a1, and x1, that's one of the things you have to model, can depend on a1. Because a1 does not have a causal interpretation in that conditional distribution, because you're conditioning on x2, which is an effect.
Yeah, but I'm not conditioning on x2 until I'm here, until it's in my data. So I only condition for those people who are actually seeing. I'm not conditioning on X2 here. I'm conditioning on the X2 at 6 months when that reading is actually available.
Suppose
I'm not doing this.
It's a more complicated problem where whether you took, even when you took A2 equal 1, there was an X2 and an A2.
Well, I don't have them. I don't have them. No, I would not. I just condition on what I have at the time.
And what would you predict?
I would predict this. If I knew A1 was 1, I would predict this.
You'd predict Y. So suppose there's another split. A1 goes to X2, goes to A2, which also goes to Y.
You could switch off. So the treatment could be switched off.
On and off.
Yeah.
The association with A1 and Y then is an integral over some weights on A2.
Yeah. I mean, I can.
Nothing to do with anything causal.
If I make a prediction, I will only base my prediction on what I have then at the time when I'm pretending to sort of printing the predictor distribution. Well, I can either fix these things and say I will follow this protocol. So then I would, like in the G computation, I would fix what I'm going to do, but I can't fix that because I don't have that. So the predictive distribution is based on what I believe I have now, and like the doctor now has at the baseline when he actually decides on this, but he would not know the X2.
No.
Okay. No, I'm not conditioning on that patient following this. I'm saying for my predictive distribution, I'm thinking about some guy who actually will follow at 6 months A2 equals one. So okay, I'm not going to condition yet.
Yeah. I want to change his mind that A2.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I haven't thought about this, but I think it can be done in the same. It's not going to violate this. Well, I'm thinking that you first read X and then you decide on A. And that's also in the data, so that in fact, it was not a randomized clinical trial at all. So they had this at the baseline. And then at 6 months, they recorded whether AZT had been initiated between baseline and 6 months. And then they say, okay, it has been, but they didn't say when, for example. Yeah.
They are all measured at the same time.
Well, this is measured at 6 months. This is measured at the baseline.
No. I mean, more than one X variable at a given time. When you have, you just said that you have two more hypovariants, not only three.
I don't.
Maybe I misunderstood.
Yeah. Yes, when you make the predictions.
Right.
Because in the data, they are fixed. That's all right. So you can condition them when you move on. But for the prediction, because you're going to apply your protocol based on the measured values. For this generic guy, you don't have the value beyond at 6 months. You have to predict it, and then you plug in whatever protocol you're following.
Mm-hmm. In most real cases,
yeah.
How do you deal with the time sequence, with the fact that they all measure at the same time?
Well, I mean, I could think of this as a vector. I could think of this as a vector. But if this is at 6 months, this is a baseline, then I have to be making a model for this based on this. So I would have to make a multivariate F function, which has, as its argument, it has as this vector, and it's trying to predict this vector. So conceptually, it's no different, but computationally, it can be very, very different.